Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Cheryl Sweet. Cheryl Sweet is a living miracle of resilience. At just 19 years old, a near-fatal skiing accident on January 31st, 2000, left her with undiagnosed cervical spine fractures that changed her life forever. On her 23rd birthday, she was diagnosed with von Willebrand disease, a rare and life-threatening bleeding disorder. Over the years, Cheryl has faced a complex web of medical challenges, from gastroparesis, GERDs, gastritis, IBS, celiac disease, and severe asthma to spinal stenosis caused by spina bifida occulta and 6 genetic mutations linked to her father's dioxin exposure overseas and stateside. Now, 25 years later and 15 years beyond her life expectancy, Cheryl continues to defy medical odds. Her story is one of science, spirit, and unstoppable strength. And with that, Cheryl, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the program today.
Thank you, Dave. I'm greatly happy to finally be on the show. And I know we've been postponing it for a few times due to my surgery schedule, but I'm happy to finally be here to be able to talk to you about my story.
I am grateful to have you here and for you to be able to share your story, because I think it'll be a benefit to individuals who are going through similar challenges or just life challenges in general. First thing I got to do is I got to give a shout out to a mutual friend of ours, Tammy Zumbo. Tammy's been a dear friend of mine for a long time, and she introduced me to you. And I come to find out, when we originally talked, we found out that we had crossed paths and trainings in the Capital District area. And so it's like, you know, it's full circle. You know, the older I get, the smaller my world gets. So like you said, it's been a year-long process to get you on the program, but life gets in the way of a lot of our best intentions, and your health is a priority, and you had to take care of your health and do what you needed to do to get to this point today. So
yeah, I'm very grateful Tammy introduced us. And yes, I do remember working with you in 2015 and taking in, I think it was like close to 2 or 3 classes with you in the Capital District. Those were very beneficial. And then when Tammy brought us back together, because I work with Tammy, she is one of my mentors. And she was like, I'm going to reintroduce you with Dave. You know Dave? I said, well, I took some classes with him almost back in like 2015. She's like, I got to get you guys together.
And she did. And Tammy's very intuitive. She's an empath, and her intuition is usually right on point in terms of who she gets together, the paths that she takes. So, and like I said, I'm glad we finally reconnected.
Yes, I'm very glad we reconnected too.
So I have a bunch of questions for you, as you know, and I'm sure you got a bunch of answers for me. So
I'll fire away.
I will do that. So first of all, tell our audience about the health challenges that have shaped your life path and your passions today.
The medical story of how this all started. I was 19 years old when my entire life got flipped upside down. Essentially, I had a devastating skiing accident on January 31st, 2000, out at Jiminy Peak in Massachusetts. I actually was there because I just got 2 feet of fresh powder, and I love skiing fresh powder. I was there with the person I was dating long term, with one of his friends, and we were skiing multiple runs that day. I think we were close to 8 to 9 runs in, and the conditions changed because we were going from the afternoon skiing and we're going in night skiing. So the conditions can change in a matter of seconds. So I ended up going down one of the normal trails I usually go down. It went from straight powder to sheer ice and I went airborne. And next thing I know, I'm just going end over end. I did not know what was happening. And it was just one of those really crazy experiences where I didn't know if I was going to make it. All I knew is I heard stuff snapping. And then I finally landed at the bottom of the trail before it breaks off into the next section. And the gentleman I was dating and his friend who was ski patrol for another ski resort got a hold of ski patrol to help make sure I could get the ride of shame back down to the lodge. And then they had to create like a cardboard cast. But the guy I was dating at the time was trying to make sure I was conscious, because when I came to, I was screaming because of the pain. I initially thought I broke my leg because I kept hearing the breaks. I did not realize it was my neck fracturing at the same time and my spine. And so what happened was we were more worried about the leg. And so ski patrol make a cardboard splint for me with duct tape. And we got ourselves back to New York and back to where I live in upstate New York. And then I went to the emergency room. They were doing x-rays and they're like, you have to go see orthopedic tomorrow. And this isn't good. And so I met with orthopedic the next day. Mind you, I was in my last semester on my chemistry degree because I was on a fast track. I had a whole career set when I was 18, 19 years old. I was like, okay, I'm doing this, and this. I'm already on my set. And so when I met with the surgeons, they were like, we definitely think you blew your ACL. We got to do an MRI. And unfortunately, the technology back then was very primitive. And the scans were primitive because what they were showing was, yes, the ACL on my left knee was torn in multiple places. The MCL, which is your anterior ligaments, that was torn as well, but they can't do surgery on those because MCLs tear regularly on an average human. Mm-hmm. So they scheduled an emergency surgery for me. And the only reason back then I had the incident on the 31st of January, which was a Monday. I had the surgery 2 weeks later on a Saturday. And the reason being was that I was actually enlisted in the student flight program at the 109th, Stratton 109th in Scotia-Glenville area, which is outside of Schenectady, New York. And it's a hybrid program that they had back in the 90s. I enlisted on my 19th birthday. And what I was doing was doing the med tech program. I was working in the phlebotomy lab and essentially I was interning at that point. So what they do is they had you be enlisted and then you still attend your civilian college. So I was going to the local community college to finish my chemistry degree. So I just finished OCHEM 1. So that's organic chemistry. I was going into second part of organic chemistry so I could graduate. And then afterwards, after I graduated, go down to Texas and then start my schooling and then go on 18 months between schooling and hospital rotation. And so basically my whole world was flipped upside down that day. And the next few days, the doctors are telling me, okay, we think it's ACL. Definitely. We could do a bone graft. We can't put metal in your leg. So we're going to do polyethylene screws. They eventually will dissolve, but we cannot put any metal in your legs due to the fact that you are enlisted. I said, okay. So we tried to keep in contact with my squad to let them know what was going on. My master chief didn't know what was going on. And they were horrified because I was, in this training program. And so we went in for surgery and what was supposed to be a 1 hour surgery and an out has, they just said, we're just going to do the bone graft. We're going to take part of your tibia, which is your bone in your shin. And we're going to take a piece of that and we're going to graft it into your knee and then put screws in to hold it together. Mm-hmm. Problem was, is that when they opened up my leg, the doctors were like, oh my God, this is a lot worse than we thought. And they realized I had no cartilage in my knee. They realized that my femur, which is the bone in your thigh or quad, was actually digging the inside of my kneecap, which is also called a patella. So it was digging out. It was basically grinding it the whole time since I was born. And they had all they could do to put my leg back together and fix what they could. They did do the bone graft. But when I came to out of recovery and they had me in a room, I woke up and I was in the most horrific pain and I had no function on my left leg. And they said, we're sorry, but the surgery went for just over 3 hours and we had no control over this. And we have to let you know that you're going to have to learn how to use your leg all over again. You're going to have to learn how to walk again. And we do not know how long your recovery process is going to be. And my heart just sank because now I felt beyond broken at that point at 19 years old. So that was the start of the surgical part. I started intensive physical therapy 3 times a week. I worked with 3 physical therapists here in my hometown, and that helped. We were also worried about the fact that we knew there was going to have to be a second surgery within the following year to clean out my knee, to get debris, bone fragments, and scar tissue out, because it was very hard for my leg to heal. It was also very hard for my leg to be able to do a full revolution on a bike. It took close to almost 6 weeks to be able to do a full revolution on a bike because of how bad it was. And also, I started having severe blood pooling on my leg underneath. Actually, they were starting to bring medical students and physical therapy students in to use me in the case study because they couldn't figure out what was going on. Why are there so many complications with this? We've never seen this before. Mm-hmm. And so that was the beginning of the journey. And so then I, you know, went back to college. I continued taking organic chemistry too and took one other class, and I just went part-time. So my father would bring me to school in the back of my parents' SUV because I couldn't bend my knee for 30 days. That was with a bone graft, you can't bend your leg for 30 days. So it was very tough. I was in a stabilization leg brace, so it was locked in at all times. And it was very complicated, and I was still trying to go to school. I was still trying to have a normal life, but you're on crutches constantly. And it was just very surreal to me. I thought I was having a out-of-body experience the whole time. I just kept saying, am I going to wake up from this? So that's kind of where it started with the accident. Later on, in the summer of 2002, it was August. I can actually tell you the date because it's how it was just surreal. August 18th of 2002. I was on vacation in Chicago with the same gentleman I was dating at the time of the accident. And we were visiting his family out in Chicago, but we were about to go downtown Chicago because they lived up on the north side, and we were about to get on the train. And I just said, I don't feel good. We need to go back to the house. And I got so violently ill. I spent a few hours in the bathroom. My whole body was just shutting down. I didn't know what to do. They rushed me to the emergency room because of how sick I was getting. And the emergency room basically, you know, said, you're the most healthiest sick person we've ever seen. We never think that something's wrong with you. So they handed me some antibiotic, you know, just saying, oh, well, we think it's this, this, and this instead. And I'm just like, no, something's not right here. So 2 days later, I fly back to New York. I have to meet with the clinics because they said, oh, it has to do, because also my menstrual cycle started at the same time, which was not supposed to start. Mm-hmm. So they didn't know what was going on. So the doctors in Chicago couldn't figure it out. And they're like, oh, well, you're an out-of-state patient, so you have to go back to your domicile, which was New York State. So I went back to upstate and I went back to the clinic that I worked with, because back 20 plus years ago, you had to go to a clinic to get birth control or hormone replacement because I was placed on hormone replacement at 16 years old due to heavy menstrual cycles. And because they couldn't figure out why I was having, you know, heavy menstrual cycles, complications with surgeries, that kind of stuff. So they did a bunch of testing. It was 2 weeks before final, and I just was about to start college on the state. So I was working on my bachelor's degree in a different major at that time, because I already had my degree in chemistry, but then I went on to get a degree in geography, but specialized in cartography, GIS, satellite imagery analysis, which is called remote sensing and urban and environmental planning. I would go to school 3 days a week, and then I would drive upstate to the Albany area or out where I live to get my testing done. And it was 2 weeks before my first semester junior year. And I was asking for an update, and the doctors weren't telling me anything. So I went and looked at my medical chart. I said, can I please read my medical chart? And this is before HIPAA went into effect. And it said that they confirmed I did have a miscarriage from blood work. And then they also confirmed from scans and from the ultrasounds that I have endometriosis. I was shocked, dismayed. And I looked at the doctors and I said, okay, what is going on with all this? And they said, we don't know what's going on. And we didn't want to tell you to hurt your feelings. I said, well, I don't care about my feelings. I need to know the truth of what's going on with my body. And that was, it was very hard for me because I didn't know how to explain it to my longtime boyfriend. I tried to sit down with him multiple times to have the talk about things. And I was very depressed, especially for the fact that at the time I did not want children, but I could never have children now at this point. They also referred me to Albany Medical Center's hematology department. They said, we need to have you meet with them in 2003 because we need you to start being tested. We think you have a bleeding disorder. And I said, okay, this is going to be interesting. So I was just in dismay of everything. I was still trying to hold all my classes. I was pouring my heart and soul in my work because I always figured work will see you through, because I just didn't know what to do with myself. I did not realize that, you know, my body just couldn't do certain things. And I was so scared to talk to, you know, tell everybody what was going on. And also it was getting so bad. But, you know, it settled down some of the symptoms with regarding my GI issues, but it started flaring up again in the end of March of 2003. I just came back from a conference in New Orleans and I got very, and the symptoms started right back up again. And I went to meet with my GP locally. They set up a GI series for April 15th of 2003. The first one, they misread the report. They were requesting me to go in for surgery because they thought I had a malrotation of my small intestine, which was not true. The surgeon had the test redone and they found out that you're going to have to go in for emergency colonoscopy by, it was June of 2003. I was 22 years old having my first emergency colonoscopy. And they found that I had originally diagnosed with microscopic colitis and had polyps. And there was a history on my father's, from my father being exposed to the dioxins where he had to have mandatory colonoscopies. So they put it into, oh, well, that's a whole new section. So at this point, things are getting a little out of control. My body's shutting down again. And I'm still trying to have this talk with my long-term boyfriend about, hey, where are we going on with this? We're, you know, in the long term, we're almost going on, you know, at that point, I think we were over close to almost 3.5 years. And I'm going into my senior year of college. And at that point, I just made a rash decision, but I figured it was the best decision for both of us was to end the relationship because I could not have a legacy. I could not give him a legacy. I couldn't give my parents or his family, you know, a legacy. And I noticed after I started getting sick in Chicago and stuff like that, we were kind of pulling back because I was focused on trying to go to all my medical appointments and I was going alone to all my medical appointments. So when I met with the hematology department, it was around the time of the right before the colonoscopy in 2003. So I met with them and that was over an hour meeting with the hematology department. And they were examining my body, my leg. I already had two knee surgeries at that point. So it was April 2001 when I had the arthroscopic on my left knee to clean out all the debris and scar tissue and bone fragments, which actually helped my mobility better. So I was able to walk better. I wasn't relying on pain medicine besides Tylenol. And but I was trying to limit that at all costs, but I was working out every day. I was always working out. And that was always being my thing because I've always been an athlete. And on top of that, I also had to go through the red tape and get a honorable medical with ability to re-enter discharge that started in the fall of 2001, but it was finalized the beginning of 2002. And they said, if you want to come back in, if you can pass your physical on your runs, because you were a very good runner, you can come back in. But we'll just set you at a desk job. So at that point, I was... and this was after 9/11. So my dad and I sat down and we were debating whether I should go, you know, back in the med squad or should I go JAG? Because those were the two areas. My father was kind of like, I don't want you doing tactical work. I don't want you going into certain things. I just want you to have a desk job. But unfortunately, my mother and grandmother kind of were arguing with me about that. And so was my longtime boyfriend because they did not want me to, even if I was stateside or even got deployed somewhere, they were just like, oh, something could happen. I'm like, it's a desk job. I'm not worried about it. I want to be able to serve my time. I did volunteer and I took a 6-year contract at that time when I was 19. I did abruptly end a very long-term relationship, which I had a very good life with him. We had plans for the future. but my medical was getting real. And when I met with hematology, they said, if your markers come back for this, what's called factor eight for von Willebrand's, it's a female version of hemophilia. Mm-hmm. And they said back then in 2003 was, if you test and show your markers for this, this puts you in a critical care state. Essentially, you'll be having to put all your arrangements in order, set up your funeral, make sure everything's taken care of, because we don't know how much longer you have. And I said, you're joking, right? This is a joke. And they're like, no, we're being serious right now. And so my first test was 15 vials of blood. They said it was going to take close to 6 to 8 weeks to get the results back, so they had to ship it out. Mm-hmm. And so I went about my life, and I poured myself into my internship that summer. I was working as a planning intern. I was still in contact with my long-term ex-boyfriend, just trying to figure out what to do with that. But I just was like, I want what's best for him, because he had a hard time with all my surgeries prior. And also the fact that now I'm learning I possibly could be terminal. I was like, if he hears about this, he's going to definitely fire me from that position. So as my therapists have said, you quit instead of being fired. And I said, yeah, I did, because I knew in my heart that I would be fired. So long story short, after the testing was done by hematology, they called me. This is where it was like a kick in the chest for me. It was a Friday morning, the day of my birthday, September 26th. I was turning 23 that day, and it was down at Oney on the State getting ready to leave my apartment to head up to class for my 9 a.m. class. So it was just, I'm walking out the door, bag in hand, my truck's already warming up, and my phone rings. And I said, why is Albany Med calling so early this morning? It's just after 8:30 and I got to get to campus. So I pick up, it's one of the nurses I've been working with. And she's like, we regret to inform you, you have von Willebrand's. And it is extremely critical. Your numbers almost do not exist. We need to get you to Albany immediately. And I said, I got to go to class. And I said, you don't understand the severity of this right now. And I said, oh, I understand the severity of it, but I also have classes. I'm in my senior year. I got to graduate. And they said, you're going to be putting school on hold for right now, probably this semester and possibly the following semester. And it was definitely a kick in the chest. Later that day, I came home. I met up with friends and also my ex-boyfriend for my 23rd birthday. And I quietly just told him, look, I got diagnosed with a bleeding disorder, and this is not good. I didn't tell him that it was terminal, that I could never have children. I literally had to live in a bubble for the rest of my life and be constantly tested. I didn't want to get into all of it, but it was one of those, how do I handle this? Who can I talk to about this? Because I had no one to talk to really besides my parents, and I ended that relationship. So I was just basically like, I don't know what to do. And that's when the doctors were trying to tell me how to do things and going in for infusions, because first they tested me for cymate, which they no longer offer. It was a nasal spray. So they test you first with what's called a cymate challenge. And I failed the cymate challenge. So then they called me and I said, well, now the only way you can get treated to clot your blood is to do what's called DDAVP. It's an infusion. And back in 2003, it was costing about $8,000 per bag. It was not covered by insurance. Insurance only covered 20%, and I had to pay 80% of it. So my medical bills were starting to pile up exponentially. So my father and I were trying to figure out what to do. We didn't know what to do. At that point, I was debating whether to drop out of college. I did drop a lot of my classes, but I kept two classes and kept them as incompletes and talked to my department chair saying, look, I'm in a world of trouble right now with my health. I don't know what's causing it. I don't know what's happening. They're constantly testing me and something's not right. And they said, well, you can take incompletes. And if you have to take sabbatical for medical, we understand. But then you can just finish up your classes part-time and then we'll just still at least get you to graduate because your GPA is so high that you still will get an honors rating. So that's essentially what I did. When I went back to college, I had my per my father's request, my mother came down with me to Oneonta State to stay with me and make sure I was doing okay. And then also making sure she could drive me to my appointments in Albany and up in Saratoga and whatnot. So that's kind of where it was with all that. I did graduate with my bachelor's. A lot of my classmates didn't know if I was going to be able to graduate because my health was failing that quick. And then so I started showing signs of gastroparesis in late 2004, beginning in 2005. I didn't know what it was. Every time I tried to hold down a meal, couldn't hold down anything that was solid food. So I was working with a new GI specialist. Once I got the designation that I had von Willebrand disease, the Department of Health labels you critical care. So The hospitals here locally where I live could not handle my case. I had to go to Albany for every one of my doctors. So For GI, I had to work with a specialist who specialized in von Willebrand disease. I finally found an OBGYN that specialized with von Willebrand disease. My surgeons were now aware of this. So we were trying to figure out a bunch of stuff. It was one of those surreal moments of, okay, how am I going to survive? And when I started doing the infusions and pumping me full of medications to keep me going and saying, here's all these side effects. We're going to keep treating the side effects of everything that's going on. And that's when I ended up gaining 138 pounds in less than 8 months. Yeah. And I ballooned up. And some of my doctors that I started working with in the last 6 to 8 years didn't believe me until I pulled out photos. I said, no, I was almost 300 pounds. And it was horrifying. I said, I've heard the most horrific things said about me. And yeah, that's their opinion. And I just said, this is water weight and I'm going to figure out a way to do this. But it was very trying. But it was in the summer of 2005. I was already graduated. I was doing my final internship for urban planning for another county. And the doctors in Albany said, you have two choices. We either admit you into the hospital and you stay here and you get tested for all the testing you need to have done, or you have to resign from your internship and come in and you can commute in. Your parents can bring you in every day so we can test your stomach and figure out what's going on with your GI system. Because when they did the emergency endoscopy, they stopped and brought me back. And I said, did you fast? And I said, yes, for 12 hours. They said, we have a huge problem. Your stomach's impacted. So then they knocked me back out and pumped my stomach. And after that, they said, your vagus nerve is something's going on with your vagus nerve, which is causing your stomach not to work. And typically, gastroparesis is caused by being diabetic. My A1C was normal. My resting insulin was normal. Everything was normal. They couldn't figure it out. So they refer to it as idiopathic gastroparesis. And I've lived with that for well over 2 decades now. With all of these things going, I ended up having to fire a lot of my doctors. And so the last time I was in the hospital inpatient was in 2011. It was February 2011. And I just said, no more. And I said, I need to find new doctors. So I ended up firing my GI specialist because he made me antibiotic resistant because they were giving me erythromycin to treat the gastroparesis. They had me on Reglan, which caused me to start having seizures. There was a lot of adverse effects I was getting from all these medications. And I just said, I have to start from scratch. And so I got referred to a new GP. And then I got that GP referred me to a GI specialist who I've been working with since August of 2011. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Northrup. She is one of the best and compassionate and kind GI specialists I've ever worked with. My first meeting with her, it was very interesting. She basically said, Cheryl, I hate to tell you this, but you're going to have to make a huge dietary lifestyle change. And this is not going to be motivation. This is going to be discipline. And I hate to tell you what you're going to have to avoid from here on out. I said, okay, what's going on? And she said, you're going to have to avoid wheat. And I said, are you saying I'm allergic to wheat? And she's like, we don't know. The markers we've tested you for shows that you have one marker of DQ2. Technically, under conventional medicine, you have to have all four markers. Functional medicine, you only have to have one. But what happened was they told me no wheat, no high fructose corn syrup, no artificial sweeteners, no MSG, no food colorings. It could be with your medicine, but limit it. No processed foods. You have to make everything from scratch. Limit your fast food intake. And she said also with the gastroparesis, she said, you're probably going to have to go more on a liquid diet, which I already was on at that point, and eating baby food and doing smoothies. And, you know, it was one of those like, okay, now I got to start from scratch. And then I finally got an OBGYN. She's retired now, but Dr. Catherine Leopold, she was able to help me control the cycles where I could just have minimal bleeding and not have to be rushed to the hospital and rushed to the ER. And I'm thinking, you're pregnant. I'm like, I'm not pregnant. I know I'm not. And they're like, well, we just need to double test you and all this. And then, of course, you're having your infusion. And at this point, I later found out from my dad, because he was trying to hide how much we were actually spending on medical bills. And by 2020, we were close to almost $3 million in medical bills.
Wow. I've been listening very, very intently to your entire medical history. And a few things that kind of occurred to me is that at 19, you had your whole life ahead of you. And you were thinking in terms of goals, goal-oriented stuff. Getting married, having kids, completing your education, which, by the way, my kudos to you for taking organic chemistry. Organic chemistry got me into psychology. So, but the amount of losses that you had just due to your medical condition, a loss of relationships, the loss of leaving a legacy, the loss of dreams for a future. We call this in the field of thanatology, phenomenological death or phenomenological grief, where you grieve parts of yourself that have been lost because of challenges, and in this case, because of your medical issues, and also symbolic grief, where it's the loss of relationships, the loss for dreams of the future. So not only were, and plus you're dealing with the fact that you could be dead any day. I mean, this was a day, an hour by hour minute, hour by hour thing. And I know we've went to bio in terms of other complications that you had as a result of your initial diagnosis with celiac disease and a variety of other things, but you have exceeded your life expectancy by 15 years.
Yes.
So what has helped you do that? What has been the secret?
Survival for me has been a blend of conventional and functional medicine. While the hospitals were stabilizing me, functional medicine helped me heal. I also incorporated Chinese medicine. I was introduced to Chinese medicine in May of 2007. So my father believes heavily in Chinese medicine and functional medicine. So he was, and that's what saved him when he was overseas, when he was a teenager and in his 20s. So he always swore by Chinese medicine. So I blended all of those together and I combined Western pharmaceutical medication for my lungs, for the steroids for my lungs, medications for keeping my asthma under control, but also maintaining, you know, because I have chronic muscle spasms and whatnot, and but also other things. But I combined that with prescription grade supplements and vitamins, prescription grade Chinese herbs, which a lot of people in Western medicine get a little hinky about it. But what I did was make sure I had a team that I built that understood we're going to collaborate together. And because my critical care doctors were all like, Cheryl, we don't know what to do anymore. We're out of answers for you and what we can do. And Cheryl, with your science background, you're a med tech, start researching. You are now your greatest experiment. And I dove in reading up on medical studies through the National Institute of Health and through PubMed. So the PubMed database is one of them that I started looking at studies on my conditions and how could I stabilize things. And even if they were trial runs, I wanted to see what can I do under full medical supervision. So everything that I've done to treat myself is fully legal. And also I've been under full medical supervision this whole time. So my doctors do know what I've been doing to stabilize a lot of this. But essentially, with not only combining prescription-grade supplements and vitamins, I have targeted diet therapy. So I actually went back farm to table. So I will be honest, I was vegan during teacher training. I had to stop that. I was vegetarian. I had to stop that in 2017 because I had another miscarriage with my partner at the time. And the only reason I was severely anemic because I was not eating proper foods because I was neglecting animal byproducts. But the problem is that we couldn't figure out what was going on. And also in 2017, it was January 23rd, 2017, my body shut down again. And I was in my final semester when I went back to college for my paralegal degree. I was ironically at a meeting with, you know, political officials And also, I'm starting getting vertigo and my vision was getting a little weird. I'm like, something's not right. But I was very cool about it. I excused myself saying, I got to go to my night class. And I get home and I'm just like, something's not right, but I got to get the class. And I start driving and I lost my vision. And I pull over immediately and I'm like, I'm less than a mile from the house. And I call home and I said, can someone please bring me to school? I don't know what's going on, but I'm having horrific migraines. I can't see. And my vision's coming in and out. So I get a ride to my class because they had a zero tolerance. If you miss the class, you fail. That's how the college was. So even if you had a medical excuse. So I had to get a ride home that night. And we went to the doctors the next day. And they just said, well, we can't prescribe steroids and stuff like this. But we need to figure out the root cause of what's causing this because this is new. Like, we've never seen someone go blind. Like, why are you going blind now? Why are you getting migraines? Why are you having vertigo? So what we ended up doing with between the therapy, but also with the dieting, going back to my strict diet, farm to table, I started reintroducing red meat, but I only purchase it from local farms that I know what they feed the steers. I know what's being fed to them. And also, I get my eggs from the farm. I actually cook with real butter again. I cook with beef tallow. Bacon grease, you know, olive oil, real olive oil from the Mediterranean, not the clear yellow stuff you used to find at the store. I went back farm to table. I make almost everything from scratch. I figured out how to make almost any dish gluten-free and you would not know it, including Italian dishes.
Yep.
And so with that, and also using acupuncture for the last 18 years, I introduced somatic therapy in 2023. I've been doing that for the last 2 years with Allison Muir Cohen, and she's based out of the Wilton, Saratoga area. I was originally introduced to somatic therapy when I went to a retreat at Omega Institute in Rhinebeck. I worked with the meditation instructor, Jeff Warren. He's based out of Toronto, Canada, and he is an amazing teacher. I would love to take classes with him again, even if it's virtual. He ended up doing it was close to a 30 to 45 minute somatic meditation. We were going back to events during this one meditation, and I was able to go back to certain events, one of them being the accident, and be able to witness everything again as a witness and telling myself the entire time that I'm okay. And there were some other events I was working on during this meditation, but for the first time since this happened, I felt normal. I wasn't panicking anymore. I wasn't like, oh my God, I got both feet in a grave. And I've had so many, you know, they're like, oh, well, you technically have had another, your death or you died, came back, whatever. And they said, you keep coming back and there's a reason why you're here. And I said, well, I like to know the reason because I'm going through the ringer on this one. But essentially what I did was I built a multidisciplinary care team. And so that's built of doctors, specialists, the functional medicine practitioners, and they all have been collaborating with each other, especially since 2019. And ironically, my hematologist, Dr. John Del Monte, who runs the Saratoga Division of Saratoga Hematology, but it's now controlled by Glens Falls Hospital. But when I spoke with him and I said, I would like to work with you because I don't want to be constantly going in every 60 to 90 days to get my von Willebrand panel tested and having to get infusions. What can we do? And he said, let's meet and we'll figure this out. Ironically, my first meeting with him in 2013, he says, I didn't realize that you were one of my wife's patients. And I said, well, who's your wife? And he's like, Dr. Northrup. And I'm like, oh my goodness. And he's like, yeah, you're the patient that had listened to her rules and her diet plan and you took it and then spun it into your own. And he's like, okay, so now we're going to figure this out. So eventually I was referred to pulmonology when I work with a critical care pulmonologist, Dr. Rommel Govensoy. We're part of Saratoga Hospital, but now it's all controlled by Albany Medical Center. So I worked with all of these doctors. And then when my GP and everybody else could not figure out how to stabilize everything, and I was trying to do little bits with acupuncture itself, but then I needed some type of functional medicine. And I have to give a huge shout out to my former teaching partner, Matt Edwards, who is also a holistic health coach. He got his health coach certification from the Institute of Integrative Nutrition. And he ended up taking different classes. This was all a whole online program, but one of the guest speakers was Dr. Mark Hyman. And Dr. Hyman started talking about symptoms that I was experiencing, because going back to being blind in 2017, it was a vestibular therapist. When she touched my neck on the back of here, which has your different nerves for your vision and whatnot, everything went off at once. And Matt was there because he was just being there as a support, you know, as a friend and whatnot. And he saw everything happen. He's like, okay, you're not going crazy. This is really happening to you, because I had emergency CAT scan. I had an MRI in my brain, CAT scan in my brain. They thought I was having a stroke. It wasn't a stroke. It was essentially something was wrong with my neck. But the chiropractor at the time could not treat my neck because they were afraid that we know there's fractures somewhere, but we can't find them on the scans. And they MRI'd my neck and they couldn't find the scans, find the fractures. So I learned how to track and comprehend every lab result, my insurance claims, my policy changes, so I can make informed medical decisions instead of reactive ones. And in 2011, I put my foot down with all my doctors. I said, you are not going to admit me into the hospital again unless I review every test result. We have a sit down. And we figure what is the best route to take. I said, because if I can treat myself at home, I will do so. And at least at home, I know that my food's going to be clean. I know that I'm in a clean environment because I've had a compromised immune system for over 2 decades now because of this issue. And, you know, just trying to figure that all out. My acupuncturist, Deborah Kozlowski, who I've worked with for over 18 years, she was just introduced to a new functional medicine center in Latham. The practitioner's name was Natasha Ruiz. And she's like, I think you need to work with her. So I called up and set up an appointment, and it was cash price. It was very expensive, but the first appointment, I believe it was $500, but it was a 2-hour appointment. And she went through from birth to current day. And she said, I'm going to be running a lot of blood work on you. We're going to run a DNA panel with blood work. So this can go into my chart. So that way there was a record, because we needed to create a medical history record that I could carry with me. That way records weren't getting lost. And when I came back 6 weeks later with my test results, she told me, she's like, you have 6 DNA mutations. And one of them is an MTHFR mutation. And out of the MTHFR mutation, I have a copy of each of, because there's different variants of the severity of the MTHFR mutation. So I do have one copy of the C677T, and then I have one copy of the A1298C. Those two copies means you're in dire danger. It means that you are still critical care, and it gives you a whole list of issues that I already was facing. So also they tested me for high levels of mold toxicity. I was highly toxic. So at that point, we went on a full detox program. And I also was mourning because I finally was reading my test results and I'm finally getting answers, because the conventional doctors even said, we can't go beyond our scope of practice. However, if you go functional medicine, yes, you have to pay cash price, but your blood work's covered by insurance. Most of the tests were. Some of them we had to pay cash between insurance and what I paid cash price. It was close to $23,000.
Yeah.
And so we were able to pinpoint all that together. So that was the one part, but that's where we got with that. So,
yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, and I'm in my own life, I've really been a firm believer in functional medicine, because functional medicine will get to the root cause of any medical issue. But I think between functional medicine and conventional Western medicine and holistic therapies, all three of those combined can, I think, lead to better healthcare outcomes, better mental health care outcomes, better physical health care outcomes. And the other thing, because you embraced functional medicine, you were able to find that you had some specific genetic markers that were causing a lot of the pre-existing issues, and you might not have gotten to that point. So I think, you know, I think the fact that you've lasted long after your life expectancy was supposed to end is a tribute to a lot of the holistic practices that have been proven, I think, to prolong quality of life. So I'm thankful that you've gotten to this point, because we wouldn't have been able to have this conversation otherwise. So, but there's a couple, there's a couple other questions I want to ask you, because I know we're getting close to the end of our time.
Yes.
For those of you who are going to see this podcast on YouTube, you're going to see in the background, Cheryl has a logo called The Sweet Awakening. And I know this is relating to your upcoming podcast. So tell us about your upcoming podcast. How is this kind of an extension, or how is this your podcast going to mirror what you've gone through with your medical challenges? And what do you hope listeners take away from it?
Well, Sweet Awakening is a raw, real, and inspiring space where healing meets rebellion. I'm known as the rebellion healer amongst my medical team. I will literally challenge anything and everything within legal means. It's about surviving the unimaginable, not just physically, but emotionally and spiritually, and transforming that pain into power. Each of my episodes, some of them are going to be solo episodes. Some of them are going to be collaborators with some of my treatment team. I'm also trying to talk to some people who have actually survived critical care instances that are still living, that were also given the same prognoses with other disorders or similar medical diagnoses. But my episodes are going to be blending storytelling with science and spirituality. I'll be sharing lessons from over two decades of in and out of critical care, as well as, basically, my mission is simple: to remind people that no matter how broken you feel, you can rebuild stronger, smarter, and sweeter than before. And also, I'll be breaking down how to navigate the insurance world and also to get financial aid through the hospitals, because people don't realize you can get financial assistance for medical treatment. The insurance companies, I have learned, it's a second language. I have learned how to work my way through the system since I was 21 years old. And also, my podcast will be talking about metaphysical death and medical grief. A lot of doctors have asked me to talk about, they asked me to write books or do a podcast, because also a lot of my medical conditions, idiopathic gastroparesis, we finally figured that out in March of 2003 when I was introduced to Natasha Ruiz's she shared space with the chiropractic office called Sternigular Chiropractic. I was working with Dr. Mike Messinas and his lead partner, Dr. Days. My first appointment with them, they looked at me and they were examining my neck and they realized, oh my God, C1, C2 are out, rib one's out. And they put the first adjustment in, and my body did an alt control delete where my whole body started reacclimating to itself. And that was something that was life-changing. And actually, since I started working with Dr. Mike and Dr. Dave, I've been able to stabilize the majority of the symptoms that started in 2002, to the point where my doctors, my critical care doctors, are like, we only need to see you once a year now. Call us if you got a problem.
Yeah, and considering where you were being told that you were literally given a death sentence when you were diagnosed with von Willebrand's disease, and the fact now that you have to call when you need me, that's a testament to the progress that you've made, the resilience that you've demonstrated, and your refusal to be a bystander in your own medical treatment. I mean, you took an active role, and I think more patients need to do that. They need to realize that they need to work collaboratively with their doctors and not effectively have treatment done to them, but dictate and find out what treatment options there are and determine what treatments are going to be best for them in collaboration with their functional medical doctors, their medical doctors, or their interdisciplinary team. So, yeah, I've already subscribed to your podcast, by the way, so I may be your first subscriber. So,
I did see that this morning. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, and I'll be doing the soft launch of that this fall. So I'm already doing some recordings and some editing. A lot of it is going to be solo episodes, because I'm going to be, for educational purposes, even though I'm under full medical supervision, I will be talking about my medical disorders and how I've been able to stabilize using non-invasive methods. Yep. So,
well, it'll be a podcast that I think will be very impactful, and I'm looking forward to listening to your episodes and welcoming you to the podcasting community. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. There's one message, one brief takeaway you want our listeners to have today, what would that be, Cheryl?
Never underestimate your ability to rise again. No matter how many times life tries to break you, healing isn't linear. It's messy, painful, and beautiful all at once. You don't have to be fearless. You just have to keep showing up for yourself. Every day you wake up is another day and another chance to rewrite your story.
Absolutely. Our narrative continues to be written every day we wake up, every new interaction we have, every new teaching that we embrace. So that's a beautiful takeaway for our audience. So thank you for that, Cheryl. Now, how can listeners reach you, learn more about your work? What's the best way for them to do that?
The best way listeners can get in contact with me, I will be doing the soft launch of Sweet Awakening podcast this fall. It will be running on multiple podcasting platforms, but it will also be on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. And I do have a professional Instagram account that will have updates and behind the scenes reels and possible future speaking engagements. For interviews, collaborations, or advocacy counseling, they can reach out to me through my official Instagram page, which is at the Sweet Awakening, or by email at thesweetawakening@gmail.com. That's where I share the latest episodes, events, and resources for chronic illness warriors and spiritual healers alike. I'm even considering doing live Q&As on YouTube, just bring people in. If you have questions regarding subjects on medical topics, on DNA mutations, I'm gladly able to answer questions within my scope I'm able to speak about, because what I talk about, this is education purposes, even though I'm under full medical supervision.
Yeah, and it makes sense. I mean, ethically, and we really can't talk beyond our scope of knowledge anyway. I learned that as a therapist. So I would always tell my students or tell a client, look, I can't do brain surgery as a social worker. So if you're looking for something beyond my expertise, I'm going to need to refer you out for additional services. So, but Cheryl, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation today. I really enjoyed our time together, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
Yes, I had a great time speaking with you, Dave. I'm finally happy to be able to meet up with you, and I look forward if we could meet again and go on to other topics I know we discussed prior. So I look forward to meeting with you again.
You got it. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.